You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello there, this is Stuart Goldsmith. Welcome to the show. I'm recording this in Sydney in the airport, specifically the baby change area. So I hope I'll just knock this off in 2 minutes and get on with it. Right, I'll throw myself straight into this. The interview that you're about to hear was recorded in Auckland, New Zealand, at the Brilliant Comedy Festival there. It's my new favourite festival. And, well, I'm not going to say I didn't just win an award. Frustratingly, most Kiwi headliner shows at that festival clashed with a group show I was doing. And although I saw loads of very exciting newbies, New Zealand bees, I suppose, I didn't manage to record any podcast with any local acts. Fingers crossed I managed to get back there next year and I can get properly stuck in pod-wise. One guy, however, that I have seen numerous times is an Australian act who me and some other British comedians had enormous fun touring New Zealand with and who is of absolutely stellar quality. So I'm very pleased to have him on the show. This is Tom Gleeson. When was the last time you were in the UK?
2011.
Okay.
I went over to do the Kilkenny Comedy Festival, which I know is not in the UK. I know Australians don't know much.
I nearly spurted my water then.
I know Australians don't know much, but that's the last time I was in that area.
Okay.
And I did some gigs in London when I was there as well. I did like the Boat Show and the Oxford Glee, where I met James Acaster.
Oh, yeah. And, I didn't realise you guys had met before.
Yeah, I'd met him one time, yeah.
Sure.
And what else? And I don't know, just some gigs around London.
Okay.
But that was the last time.
Okay. Yeah. So for the benefit of people in the UK who might not or know who you are of, you're a comic of some standing, would you say, in Australia? You've done a bit of TV, radio presenting,
yeah.
You've done quite a lot of different things.
I've sort of been on TV for about 10 years in various forms. So people in Australia tend to know who I am, but I can't claim, I'm not like the biggest comedian in Australia, I'm like... I would say I'm not a household name, but people who are into comedy definitely know who I am.
Okay.
But you know, various people's aunties may not have heard of me.
Sure.
But, you know, I'm out there. People point at me in the street.
Yeah,
they don't always know my name.
Sure. You were saying before that you're at the level of wearing a cap in public so that a third less people point at you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my friends kind of... They take the piss out of me when I wear a hat because they think that I wear a hat because I think I'm famous. And I'm like, no, I wear a hat because I am famous. And and it just cuts down on people having a chat to you. That's all.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
If you can just trick one out of three people into not staring at you, then I'll wear a hat.
Yeah, okay.
And my head's quite distinctive. So, you know, I'm quite tall. My wife said this about me, actually. She said, people would stare at you just anyway.
Okay, that's
even if you
true.
Went in comedy, because I'm quite tall, I've got red hair and I'm balding, so I'm quite prominent, so I tend to stand out in a crowd anyway.
Okay.
So people are like, who's that tall weirdo? Oh, hang on, he's someone we know.
Yeah,
so,
sure, okay.
Yeah, so it's really risky.
So, and I first saw you, you were in Adelaide, but I think our shows were at the same time, so I didn't see you there. The first notice I had of you was your poster for your current show, which is called Hello Bitches.
Yeah.
And you've got a very nicely, very cleanly designed poster which says exactly that.
Yeah.
This was dear to my heart because my last show was called Prick, and I quite liked that sort of the affront of, you know, a poster and an insult and a thing.
Yeah, well, you know, so many posters in festivals, they're about trying to get people to like you, so I just thought it'd be funny if you made a poster that almost was suggesting that you didn't want people to come to the show. It just looks funny.
Sure.
And also, I'm fairly... I've got a reputation for being fairly friendly anyway, so it's kind of...
Have you?
It's kind of contrary to...
That's funny to hear.
It's kind of turning it on its head a little bit.
Sure, sure. Okay, that's funny, yeah. Because from the perspective of a newcomer to that kind of the Australian comedy scene, I was like, oh, he must be one of those badass guys. Do you know what I mean? So they're like, oh, you're happy to risk looking a bit smug and mean and stuff like
having
that.
A show called Hello Bitches, there's a certain amount of irony.
It's a joke about the fact that you're... Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But you are, I mean, you are clearly, you have a lot of confidence. You're sort of aware of your, you can talk frankly about your position in Australian comedy.
Yes.
Like.
Yeah, and also because, I mean, I've had it in, like, my general life rule is I run in the other direction, like, with anything. Like, I tend to, like, if everyone's doing one thing, I just tend to do the other thing. And it's something that's, I've felt for my whole life. Like, you know, if everyone decided that shirt was nice to wear at school, I'd think, well, I'm never wearing that shirt.
Okay.
I just have a natural sort of cynicism.
Is that why all your clothes are rubbish?
Yeah. Pretty much. But as a result of that, in Australia, self-deprecation is rife. Like, it's really inherent in all the humour.
Okay.
It's inherent in the way that people talk about it. So for me, the idea of being confident was original.
Okay.
In a weird way.
Sure.
So I happened upon that about 7 years ago. I just decided, what would it be like if I was happy to be on stage and I was confident with what I was doing? And if anyone asked me about what I did, I just said that I was good at it.
Yeah.
And it just, even just saying it, just sounded funny and different.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's pretty standard for me when I do press interviews and stuff in Australia. They say, so, you know, is your show, what can we expect? I'll be like, well, you can expect me to be nailing it and destroying. Because everyone's in Australia's like, oh, gee, I hope it's okay, you know.
Sure.
So
sure.
I just sort of do it for contrast.
Sure. And that's something that really, that comes out of every pore of your, I mean, we've been on tour together for a week, so I've seen you lots there, and I've seen your hour the other night, which I thought was really excellent. And it has confidence coming out of every pore of it. Like, even in the way, it's almost like your stagecraft is so lean and simple and definite.
Yeah.
Like the way you kind of close your closing bit about, like, do you get what's going on here?
Yeah.
You've got for the benefit of the listener, Tom has a routine where you kind of tell an outlandish sexually based story.
I tell an outlandish story. And then at the end, because it's, you know, it doesn't paint me in a good light, I say to the audience, yeah, I'm checking whether they understand stand-up and do they get the concept of stand-up comedy. And I explain to them that I'm exaggerating. It's not all true. So then I tell them the true story about what actually happened.
Yeah.
But then when I correct the story, I make it even worse.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But there's something in the manner in which you do that. It makes me... One of the things I thought was, have you worked with a director?
No.
On that show. Then as soon as I thought that, I thought probably you haven't, but that's the thing I'm talking about, is you look like you've been directed because everything's so clean and simple. Like, there's no frills on any of it. It's, I mean, me and Birdie were saying this, your hour was just club funny stand-up after club funny stand-up. There wasn't a 3 or 4 or 7 minute bit that couldn't work perfectly well headlining a club.
Yeah.
None of it was fragile.
Yeah, for people listening in the UK, I do a one-hour show every year, like the Edinburgh model, but I just don't go to Edinburgh. I do it in Melbourne instead, and I've been doing that for about 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I always work up my show through clubs, so the bits tended to have had their birth in clubs.
Sure.
So usually I start my whole run just working up bits and pieces in clubs, and then those pieces I kind of get to about half an hour, and that way I feel like I'm close to festival ready. And then there's some longer stories in there, and there is quite often I take risks with stories which I think aren't club worthy because they're a bit too long or a bit too interesting or a bit too off colour or a bit too revealing maybe, and I'll put them in the show. But by the time I finish the festival run, then they all tend to be club ready as well.
Yes,
because they've just you know received a belting from several different audiences.
Sure. Okay. We'll come back to that actual process in a little while. But one of the things I wanted to say just while we're on the subject of that kind of confidence is the first time I actually saw you perform was at the gala when you were... The gala in Melbourne.
Yes.
When you were... That stuff with your bank details, that was improvised.
Yeah.
So that's fascinating to me because you were comparing a televised... And it was, did it go out live or it went out a day later or something?
Yeah, it went out a week later, yeah.
Okay. But it was a big, big deal. I don't know how many thousands of people that.
Yeah, it was like 2,000 people. Sure. The opening night of the Melbourne Comedy Festival. Yeah,
and you
done
went
for TV. Yeah,
sure, sure. And you went on and said, "Oh, it's a gala. We're all here to raise money." And then you gave out your actual account details and said, "Send in money." It was, you know, yeah, you weren't trying to trick anyone. Yeah. You were sort of satirizing the whole gala.
Well, to explain, give it a bit of background. In Melbourne, there is the Oxfam Gala. And then there's the opening night gala. They're two different opening nights. And the Oxfam gala, they raise money for Oxfam. And this one, the one I hosted, doesn't raise money for anyone. You get paid as professional. So I was just mocking that. And also, I also thought it gave me something to do because I was the host. When you host the Oxfam gala, you've got something to do because you've got to keep on spruiking the phone number.
Yeah.
So I thought, I've actually got nothing to do in terms of being a host. I really am just here to say, we're all going to watch comedy. Let's all enjoy the comedy. So I thought, I want something else to talk about. So, yeah, I just said to the audience, we're not raising money, but if you still feel like you want to give, transfer money to, and I gave out my bank account details on national TV. And then that was funny because the jeopardy for me that was funny, that made it funny was, is it really my account or is it not?
Yes.
And I said to the audience that I'll pass it on to charity anyway, or not.
Yeah, sure.
So I very honestly said to the audience, just give me your money.
Yeah.
And I'll either pass it on or not, but you will never know the answer.
Yeah.
And then the other part that amused me was I was chatting to this comic in Melbourne. His name's Tommy Dasilo, Melbourne comedian, and he said the funniest part for him was I'd reduced the gala down to its most basic element, because every comedian that performs, when you do a gala or any TV spot, the reason why you do it is you want everyone watching at home to think that you're funny and to think that you're so funny that they want to buy tickets to your show.
Yes.
And when they come to your show and buy those tickets, that money ends up trickling back to you.
Yeah.
And you get to earn money. Whereas I short-circuited the whole thing by just saying, give me your money.
Yeah, you needn't even come and see my show.
I'm not even doing comedy. I'm just saying I want you at home to give me money.
Sure.
Don't come to the show.
It was really funny. But my question is, did you plan that beforehand or did it evolve on stage as you were talking to us?
I like the idea of doing something risky. I didn't want to just run out and do material.
Yeah.
And I've done enough TV that I get a thrill out of being in the moment on TV.
Okay.
I think it's this. For me, the more pressure there is, the more fun it is. It was a big risk because it didn't have jokes in it as such. It was more just a funny concept. But I just sort of knew it would play well at home more than in the room.
Sure.
So I was committed to doing that because I knew that there would be a crawl underneath, and there was. They put a crawl of my account details.
Amazing.
To give. And
is that something that you set up with them or you just...
Yeah, I told them.
Okay.
So they knew I was going to give out my account details.
Okay.
So but I just, I just figured I could just go out and do material and it will be funny. But I've done that gala like, I don't know, 10 times.
Sure.
So I've already done that. So I didn't feel like... I thought I've got to do something to be a bit memorable here. I can't just be funny. I've got to be remembered somehow.
Yes.
And when you're hosting, you can just get forgotten.
Yes.
There's all these great acts and everyone forgets. So I thought I just got to do something, just some little thing to get remembered.
That's very canny. That does belie, obviously, your experience of doing it loads and loads of times. But I'm sure people could do it loads and loads of times and still stick to a safer sort of path.
Yeah, I think that a mate of mine said this. Atmal, he's another Australian comedian, and he said that everyone's funny.
Yeah.
He's like, a lot of comedians panic about being funny or not, and it's like, you're a comedian, that means that you're funny. There you go, job done.
Yeah.
What you have to do is be funny and be memorable. That's the hard thing.
Yes.
Because we're all funny. Everyone's funny. We all get laughs.
Sure.
But can you get laughs in a way that somehow people aren't getting them?
Yeah.
So that people feel like they're getting something special that they can only get from you.
Yes.
That's the hard question.
Okay.
And that's what I think festivals force you to ask. Because you're not just headlining a club. You're trying to reach out and grab just people to come and see you in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hard bit.
Something that I think that is an effect of that, I totally agree with that. I think that's a really good analysis of it. I think in Edinburgh, that has turned into this idea of having a theme.
Yes.
Like everyone wants to have a theme. Everyone's
Melbourne
trying to
has
be...
the same thing. I'm aware of it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, but I noticed that you're one of those people that, or on the basis of the one show and the one load of stuff that you're doing at the moment. What I was really impressed with was that it didn't have a theme. It didn't need to have a theme. It was just so busy being good. So how does that show fit into that idea of being memorable? How do you take that into the actual work that you're doing in an hour?
Yeah, well, I started doing shows that didn't have a theme. I think the first show I did had a theme, and then after that they didn't. Maybe the second one did too, but after that it didn't. And it was spawned by laziness, because I just thought it's much easier just to have your name and a title, and then, you know, 6 months out, you can throw into that hole whatever you're going to throw in there.
So, and you can cut whatever you want the day before you go out and do it.
Yeah, sure. But the weird thing is, on paper, I'm not very original. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a man, 38, married with a kid. I talk about that. I talk about things that everyone talks about. Mm-hmm. I think on paper, I'm not a very original act. And it would be easy to discount me as being just another act. But I think that the way that I do things is actually a bit lateral. Mm-hmm. I think that there's something about the way that I put things together. I kind of do it, you know, in a different way to what other people do. So I think that this thing that I talk about, you know, I was saying before that I'm always running in the other direction. I just feel that that makes me constantly surprising, and people are just never quite sure what I'm going to say next.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing, I think the reason why people enjoy my show is because I think there's an emotional honesty in my show, I think, that I go for. And I think that's what people connect to. A lot of people who seem to come to my show seem to be very ordinary, boring-looking men from the suburbs.
Okay.
And their wives, or, you know, ordinary, boring wives from the suburbs bringing in their husband.
Sure.
And it's, I don't know, it's sort of an angry man persona, kind of, but I don't know, it's just, I can't quite put my finger on it, but I just sort of try to talk about things in an original way.
Mm. You were talking about before you opened for Louis C.K.
Yes. He's the master of that, obviously.
Yeah.
I think he's the master of talking about ordinary things in an interesting way.
There seem to be parallels. And I was trying to sort of, watching you, I was trying to think, come on, just because he's ginger. but there is that. So what do you mean when you say that word lateral? You said there's some way that you come at yours. Because I think I know what you mean, but
yeah,
I'd like you
to
try and articulate it's a little bit more like you're not up there doing gags, though there are gags.
Yeah.
Each bit is trying to explore an idea, but not at the expense of it being funny.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. So I kind of I just see the world in a lateral way anyway, so I just sort of my stand up tends to be that way. I don't particularly find myself entertaining, I find myself quite boring because I can all the things I think all the time. But I have learned from doing stand-up that my perspective seems to be unique and entertaining and worth paying for.
Okay.
So I just trust the audience on that front. But yeah, I do tend to... I'm just trying to think of a good example. This is a fairly good example. This is a bit... I did it for a TV show. I didn't even become stand-up, but it illustrates it relatively well. Mike Hussey is an Australian cricketer, and he retired at the beginning of this year, and he was a much-loved player, family man. Three children, everyone's favourite player. His nickname was Mr. Cricket. And he retired in January and was on the front page and with his family, and he was giving all his emotional speeches. I just want to go out on top, and I'd lost the passion for the game, so I felt like I had to retire. And and all the headlines were, good on you, Mike, you know, and that kind of thing. So on TV, I said that Mike Hussey retired, and, you know, and I did a rant about how annoyed I was and like that he wanted to retire at the top, and I said, and he said that he, and the line that I picked up on, which was funny because the reason why I think this illustrates it is everyone loves Mike Hussey.
Yes, okay.
So I thought, how funny would it be to give him an absolute drubbing, you know, because he's so lovely.
Like, yes, okay.
You could not hate the guy.
Yeah.
But I thought, how funny would it be if I just hate the guy?
Find a way to hate him. Yeah, okay.
So he said the line, he wanted to retire to spend more time with his family. And the line that I said on TV was, yeah, that's all well and good, but the rest of us, we can't retire because of our family.
Yeah, okay.
We've got to go to work every day to put food on the table. No one said you're supposed to enjoy it, Mike. Get out there and score some runs, you lazy bastard.
Yeah, okay.
So that's kind of the way I come at things always, you know. If everyone loves that, I dislike it. And if everyone dislikes something, I love it, usually. That's almost the very, very basic key to my whole act.
Okay.
It unlocks the whole thing.
So this is Tom
plenty of stuff to discover about him, particularly his unshakable confidence and his very well-ordered mind. It's worth finding him on YouTube, and it's also worth pointing out, as you may already know him without realising it, as I did when I heard a YouTube clip that was one of the first things I ever recognised as a viral thing, however many years ago, in which Tom voices the role of the boyfriend whose girlfriend James Blunt is trying to chat up in the song You're Beautiful. Don't know if that rings any bells. I sat in a recording studio on a radio show with Tom, and the DJ played it, and I suddenly went, oh my God, I heard this years ago. Anyway, he's a superb act with some very, very punchy, very lean material and a very commanding manner. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. Next week, it's Tom Binns on the show. He's at a fascinating juncture in his career as he decides to morph into a straight stand-up from his current position.
Final call for Etihad flight EY451 to Abu Dhabi. Now in its final stage of boarding through gate 58.
I may as well leave that in. Tom is going to morph from a straight stand-up from his current position of being a highly successful character comedian. This is the guy behind Ivan Brackenbury and also Ian D. Montfort, two of my absolute favourite comedy characters. So loads to get our teeth into there. It's a mammoth interview. I'll have to chop it down or put some extra content out because we talked for about 2 hours. Finally, sorry about this. It's not very professional, but as you can hear, I'm dealing with an odd environment. Finally, a little competition for you. We're looking for names for tribute acts to famous comedians in the manner of, for example, the Led Zeppelin tribute act is called Let Zepp, or you've got the Bootleg Beatles or what have you. We're going to do that, but with comedians. The game is called Very Alderton, after the first one that I thought of. So I'm going to run this for a few weeks and let all of the swamped listeners catch up with you starving bastards. The winner will receive 2 free tickets to the live ComCom Edinburgh show of their choice. So at ComComPod with your entries, or you can email me info@comedianscomedian.com. And if you're tweeting, please use the hashtag #TributeComics. So that's one to start you off with, Very Alderton. And if you think you can do better than that, I've already done Ish Kumar, so you can't have that, it's been done. If you think you can do better than that, and I'm sure you can, do get stuck in. 1 entry per tweet, please, otherwise I get very swamped and lose track. Tickets are online now for the Edinburgh run. The best thing to do is go to gildedballoon.co.uk and search for Goldsmith to find the correct page. I'll be releasing confirmed dates for individual acts in a variety of fun and secretive ways in order to let regular listeners get in there first. So listen out for those, Easter eggs and so forth. And finally, absolute last chance to tell you, Benny Boot is my guest next Wednesday, the 28th of May, in the second ever ComCom Live special. Tickets are available from the link on the ComCom Facebook page, or you can check Twitter at ComComPod, or just Google up Crack Comedy, because that's the lovely club that's hosting us this time. So, right, before it goes, now back to Tom Gleeson.
Singapore Airlines flight SQ.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Let's just look at the hour that you've done recently.
Yes.
The thing that stands out most in my memory is the inoculation bit, when you're taking your baby daughter to have a horrible, painful injection.
Yes.
And the climax of that routine is you running, you know, thinking you were going to be very clever about it, and you were going to be, hey, you know, I really enjoy that. And the way the routine starts from a position of some people don't get their children injected because they're religious and or stupid superstitious, whatever. But you consider yourself above that because I'm a man of science, and it ends with you wanting to kick the nurse out of the way and go run away screaming
and losing all my faculties.
Losing all your faculties. You go bananas on stage, and I think I told you before, me and Marcus and Birdie were sat next to each other going, here we go, he's going to do this in that kind of preemptive way. So with a piece like that seems to me to be a really good example of one of the things you do, of taking the
that taking a logical idea, like such as your own logicalness,
yeah,
and then finding the hypocrisy in it, yes, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, my stand-up also isn't that calculated. It's more like I often find meanings in ideas after I've had the idea. I often retrofit the meaning to my material.
Sure, sure.
But that bit where it came from was actually just trying to describe that pain. And it was also, because it's about how you feel as a parent. And so I was trying to, it's one of those bits that came from me trying to explain to my friends that don't have children what it's like to have children.
Gotcha. So at no point in the birth of that routine did you think, right, I'm going to write a routine about this?
No.
So much as you were just telling it firsthand to people.
I was just trying to describe to people how it felt. Yeah.
Okay.
And this year, in this year's show, a lot of the routines are trying to explain how I feel about something.
Okay.
So I was trying to tap into a certain emotion as opposed to just going, this is what I think about something, which normally I say, this is what I think about something.
Okay.
Whereas this year I tried to do more of, this is how I actually feel about something. Because they say that, like, having a child makes you get more in touch with your emotions, and it's true. Sure. So I've just tried to illustrate that more. And so what better way to do it in a comedy fashion than to do it physically?
Yes.
And so that routine really, in many respects, is probably one of many ways in which I ape Richard Pryor's style. Okay. And no one would ever see that in me because we have nothing in common in terms of the lives we've led. But he acts out all the time.
Yes.
It's one of my favourite things that he does.
Yes.
And he slips into it too. Like he'll just say, so I was like walking down the street, and then he'll be walking down the street,
yeah,
reacting to people he's talking to, and he plays the scene.
Sure.
So I completely get that from him. I got that idea from him over 10 years ago, and I'm forever slipping into a scenario where I'm pretending to be someone else.
Sure.
But people don't think of me as a character comedian, but it's kind of in there a little bit.
Yes, that's true, actually. And you do have quite a facility for the little characters that just kind of come out. Like,
yeah, they're just in and out. Yeah,
yeah, you're just on, you know, in a tour bus kind of way, and all the kind of cheer, bro. And, yeah, you know, there's a particular sort of strangled New Zealand impression that you're like, oh, bro.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So those kind of things bubble out naturally. And you were saying before, we were talking about it, you were saying that you don't, I mean, do you write things down at any point? Or is it just that it happens on stage and you...
No, I don't. And again, it was motivated by laziness. It's just about having to get some minutes happening. So what I do is... there are some great clubs in Melbourne. One's called the Spleen Bar, and it's on every Monday. And it's free to get in, which sounds
This must be an incredible club. Every Australian act I've had on the podcast in the last 5 weeks has gone, so there's the Spleen Bar. It's amazing.
It is really good. It's like... it's free to get in, which makes it sound horrendous, but... For whatever reason, it's been there about 5 years, and it's got its own little life. And the main point is, it's always got people in it, and it's an open mic night, but supported by the audience. So what I'll do is I'll have a list of ideas, and I'll just go in there and thrash them out. So what I do is I never really I might have an idea like I just might write down immunisation, so I know I'm going to try to get that meaning across, and I just literally go on stage and try to get the idea across. And the desperation of having the audience look at me and me just trying to explain it.
Okay.
I've just accepted that if I stand on stage and talk for 10 minutes, it's going to be funny mostly.
Okay.
It's going to be okay mostly.
Sure.
So what I do is I just get on stage and thrash it out, and all the best punchlines seem to come out on stage. But I record it. That's the smart bit.
It's maddening. Yeah.
But that's the smart bit. Like, I record it.
Okay.
So then I listen back to it. There's also a lot of writing that happens on the way to the gig. I live an hour out of town, so I drive in and it takes an hour to get in there.
Okay.
So if I'm thinking, if I've decided I'm going to talk about immunisation, you know, being annoyed with Qantas and one other thing,
yeah,
by the time I get there, the routines are kind of starting to form in my head.
Okay.
Because I'm imagining being on stage, and
sure,
I'm imagining the moment when I say hello. How am I going to say hello?
Sure.
What's going to happen from there? So then a path just sort of starts to emerge.
Okay.
And then, so then on stage I just thrash it out, and then I listen back to it and I go, oh, that's not bad. And then I just kind of, the recording of it just, again, this process is born out of necessity. Mm-hmm. It just rapidly accelerates the generation process.
Yes.
Because you catch everything in a net. You don't lose anything. Mm-hmm. And I just keep on pushing it on to the next gig.
And when you're listening back to it, do you then make notes of it or write it down at that stage?
No.
Or is it just you're listening back to it in order to remind you?
I just listen back to it when I'm driving into the next gig that I do, usually. I don't listen back to it the next day. I usually can't find myself the time to be bothered, but then I often just listen to it in the car on the way in, and then it's kind of there.
Okay.
And so the combination of having been, you know, ruminating, like, you know, been ruminating, excuse me, about it, just anyway, just walking around the place, and then listening back to it, those two things come together, and it just naturally improves.
Okay.
So then by the time, so the list just gets longer and better, and then eventually I will, and then it's, you know, 10 becomes 15 and then 20, and then I'll be confident enough to book myself in as a headliner at some clubs.
Yes, okay.
I'll do small, like little small venues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to do half an hour and get paid for it, and I feel that it's, you know, the stuff's to a certain quality that's going to get good laughs, and that sort of gives it a, punches it up a bit more. And then I get to Adelaide. And that's where my year starts, the Adelaide Fringe Festival.
Okay.
And then I arrive.
So you kind of, Adelaide is almost preview festival,
isn't it? It's the goal, yeah.
Okay.
But at the same time, it's its own concern. Weirdly enough, the most money I earn is in Adelaide. So, yeah, I have a really big season there. So I do feel an obligation.
It's got to be ready by the time you get it.
I can't be taking the piss. You know, people are paying and expecting it to be good. But at the same time, the Adelaide Fringe, as you well know, the audience is so friendly. And it's an arts festival, so they're open to new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's February, and it's Australia, and it's summer, and it's a great time of year, and I just think everyone's in a great mood, and it's just the perfect place to launch a new show.
So when you're on stage, going back to the very beginning of that process, you've had the conversations with friends maybe that made you go, there might be something in that.
Yeah.
When you take an idea like inoculation on stage, what kind of things are you trying to pull out of it? Well, I just want to try to zero in slightly on that process of... I just try to explain how I feel. I just try to explain the idea.
Well, the key thing was the routine for me all centered around how I felt when I had to watch the needle go into my baby's thigh.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like inside I was caving in. Yeah. I felt like I could pass out.
Yeah.
And I haven't felt something like that for a long time.
Sure.
You know, and so I was, how do I get that across? How do I explain that feeling?
Yeah.
So the way I explain that feeling is, I don't know, just naturally to me it seemed funny that I'm offhand.
Yes.
Ah, it's going to be fine. It's all okay. No worries. Gotcha. It's fine.
Okay.
So that's where the beginning comes
from. So you're trying
from.
To increase the jeopardy of the situation by saying, okay,
everything's going to be fine, because I know things aren't going to be fine. So it's,
yes.
So getting a bit of contrast happening. So then how do I illustrate the pain that's going to come? And then so I try to describe the relationship between me and my daughter and what she looks like and how I feel. And
think about her little face. And then her face gets smaller when the needle goes in. That's so vivid. That's such a vivid image.
Yeah. So then the needle goes in. And at the same time, like, it's not the first time I've completely lost it on stage. I do know that carrying on and being an idiot is its own funny thing. That's kind of a bit of shtick for me.
Yes, but then it is that within... I mean, when you say carrying on being an idiot, you mean completely losing your mind and screaming.
Yes.
But what's lovely about that is, it feels like it's directed, because that's the right place in the show for that to happen.
Yes.
Part of why it's delicious isn't just that it's unusual, but that it makes perfect sense. It's unusual for you, and yet it makes sense for you because you're this ordered, logical man.
Well, no reviewers have ever picked up on it yet, which is nice, but... I haven't even heard other comedians say this, but if you watch any one of my shows, there's a very good chance that about 40 minutes in, I'm going to yell or do
something. Yeah, okay, yeah, sure.
That's my trick. That's my prop.
Yeah.
That's my guitar.
Yeah.
That's my wig. That's my glasses.
You've got to have something for the 40-minute lull.
At the 40-minute mark, something's going to happen. Something bad's going to happen.
Sure.
I'm going to scream and carry on. I'm going to pass out. I'm going to fall over. I'm going to say something horrendous. I'm going to do... That's going to be the meat in the sandwich. That's going to be the bit that's just when you think the audience might be drifting off, I'm going to do something to drag them right back in.
So what other than that, what other decisions do you make about the order of the material in your hour? If we accept that all of these bits, these are fives or sevens or whatever they are, that are all funny, and I mean, could they go in any order, or do you just kind of go, okay, funny is one last? Is there a story that you're kind of telling throughout it?
I do sort of edit for funny. That's what I do. So a story emerges from the funny. I don't try to tell a story. So what happens is usually...
You mean within an hour?
Within an hour, I'd probably go B material, C material, A material, last.
Gotcha. And then the story emerges because you just get used to saying them in that order.
Because you put them in a certain order and the story comes out of it.
So
usually... But I also kind of always try to break my own rules because I don't want to ever get stuck.
Sure.
So, but this year and probably the last couple of years, it's been fairly similar. The opening, the material that's at the top 10 minutes is always something that's, out of all the stuff that I've come up with, is probably the easiest to grab.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, quite often it's, this year it's observational material pretty much.
The iPhone stuff at the beginning, yeah.
Observational stuff about iPhones and digital cameras and various things and chatting to people in the crowd. It's fairly simple, polite material just to get people in so that you scoop everyone up. I don't leave anyone behind at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, I've done that in different ways. I think last year and the year before I did that via talking about the news, so I'd have 10 minutes about stuff in the news, because again it's easy to grab because we've all just seen the news.
Mm-hmm.
And last year I also just added an extra element of it was satirical about the way that the news is told, so I just had a bit of meat there as well. But at the end of the day, it was just a way of getting the audience in.
Yeah, okay.
So then in the middle, I usually put that would be where I put the meat. That's where I put the stuff that I feel is the hardest to get over the line, but also is hopefully the most memorable. This year, I didn't actually do it in the show that you saw, but in Melbourne, there was another story that's not in the show in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And it's about basically how I went to a christening of a friend's baby.
Mm-hmm.
And the priest, while holding the baby, said a line where he said, there are priests out there that would rather go to jail than give up the secrets of the confessional. That was his part of his sermon. So essentially he's saying if another priest confessed to child abuse to him, he would keep it a secret. So, which is a very hard topic, yeah?
Sure, yeah.
And I thought, in New Zealand, I thought, they don't know me well here, I may not get it over the line, but in Australia, that was the bit in the middle that really kind of makes time stand still. But the line that I'm trying to get to is that, you know, whatever you believe, you've got to admit, defending a pedophile at a christening while holding a baby is a bit tacky.
Yeah, that's nice.
So that's what I'm trying to get to there. So that story in this year's show was that was the hard one. I'd never talked about religion before. I was brought up religious. My parents still go to mass every Sunday.
You were brought up religious, and you've not talked about religion before in 12 hours at Melbourne.
No, never have. Okay. I just thought, not ironically, it's not irony really, but the reason why I didn't was because I thought it was too difficult.
Okay.
But it was great, because this year, in doing that, I learnt that I've got more hang-ups about religion than the audience does.
Sure.
That's something I learned.
Okay.
So that was the meat and the sandwich. And then the end, and usually what I finish with is just something that's got a big finish that I feel's got some pizzazz, going to wake people up.
Sure.
So in Melbourne, the immunisation story you're talking about was the closing routine.
Gotcha.
So I made it seem like the show was finished.
Yes.
I get feedback from the audience, do all that kind of stuff, muck around. Just when they think I'm going to finish, I just tell one last story.
Yes.
And then it's done.
Yes. Yeah. Tell me about the feedback thing. That's quite an unusual. It's, you know, I've seen people kind of go, any questions before, but you were like, you kind of.
It's the same trick,
Well, it sort of became about, it seemed to have a veneer of maybe being about reviews. You were like, rather than someone go, was sort of the punchline, wasn't it? You know, I'm inviting feedback, and you seem quite happy to, obviously, you're very secure in riffing with whatever anyone says. I mean, no one really said much the night I saw.
No. In New Zealand, it's not working as well as it has in the past in Australia. Yeah, because I've got a bit of a reputation for being good with hecklers in Australia, so it's almost making fun of that as well.
There's a bit of a frisson there.
It's like
leaving a gap. Already.
It's a bit like, you know, what's going to happen now? So, okay.
Yeah, and over here, maybe because you're a little bit more prized, maybe? You're like, he's an international.
Yes.
We don't want to
get
involved with him. Maybe.
Combined with the fact that New Zealanders tend to be reserved as a general rule, you know, I feel that as a people, they're kind of a bit more circumspect.
Sure.
But yeah, that was born from, it started really simply. I wanted to improvise more in the show. Every year, I always think I want to improvise more. Because when you do a 1 hour show, all the material gets lifted up to another level. So it all just gets lifted up a bit when you've just got that urgency in the show. So I knew I was going to talk to the crowd at the beginning, and I just thought, I always talk to the crowd and then I jettison and then it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I got it. I want to have some touchstone at the end where I talk to the crowd again.
Mm.
So I thought, how can I get to talking to the crowd? And then, so there was that thought. Then there was the thought that I was talking about religion. Like the story about religion that I tell is, it actually has a dramatic ending. It gets to a point where I'm imagining an elaborate revenge scenario with the priest.
Mm.
And it's a bit bleak, and it gets to the end, and then the lights go down, and it gets a clap because it's a well-told story, right? But then the lights come up, and then I say, any feedback? So it's like I butted against like something that's a bit controversial, and so because I'm bagging religion wholeheartedly, and then after that I go, any feedback? As in, you know, if you've got a problem with it, you can tell me about it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where that came from.
And did anyone ever...
No one ever cared.
I mean, you're quite a force of personality as well on stage, I guess.
I'm a bit of a bully, so...
You know. Well, that's your word, not mine.
Yeah, well, people don't want to, yeah.
Do you think you are? Do you think you are a bit of a bully?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And no, but I just... So with the feedback thing, there was also a story about where I mentioned customer feedback, where I'm the customer. So there's an extra element to any feedback. It's also... You're the customer. Customer's always right. And also, it's funny for comedians to watch that bit too, because what I'm saying sounds like a joke to the audience, but it's actually true.
Yes.
Because I say to the audience, if you've got any feedback, tell me, because I'll fix it for next time.
Yes.
And I've recorded this gig for training purposes, and I listen back to it.
Yes. Yes.
And comedians find it funny because, well, I'm not now, but I do record the gigs.
Yeah. Of course. Actually, there is that real element to it that people aren't aware of.
And also, I do improve the show a little bit each night. Yeah. So you know.
Come on, let's get into this bully thing. What do you mean when you say you're a bully?
Yeah, like you said, I'm a forceful presence on stage. So, I mean, the word bully has negative connotations, obviously, but I just mean that, I push the audience, I boss them around into getting them to where I need them to be. Yeah,
sure.
Sometimes I make it seem like I'm not, but I always am.
Okay, so that's interesting. I agree with you.
Because I was talking to the crowd at the show you saw, and it can seem friendly, but I'm always.
Yeah,
pushing them into a certain corner where I want them.
And to what extent do you think is that something that you find it useful or funny to do on stage, and to what extent is it a representation of your actual personality?
I think it's a little bit of both. I realised it's not a nice thing to say, but I've realised that one of the things I really enjoy about comedy, like most people enjoy stand up because, you know, they say, oh, it's really nice hearing people laugh. I actually really enjoy the power trip.
That's so refreshing to hear. Yeah, I believe you.
I really enjoy being in control. For me, stand-up is all about asserting your power over an audience via public speaking. Mm. And that's the part I really get off on. Because, like I said, everyone gets laughs.
Sure.
So you're going to get laughs, that's fine.
Sure.
So what else do you get out of it? I really enjoy being in charge of the audience. And so when I ask for feedback, I'm actually, not only am I trying to do ad-libbing.
Yes.
Not only am I trying to actually get feedback, I'm also demonstrating to them beyond doubt that I'm in charge.
Yes. Okay.
Have you got any feedback? No, you don't. You don't, do you? Why? Because it was brilliant. In case you didn't notice. Yeah.
But you have enough of...
But they're tricks, you know.
Yes. You have enough of a twinkle, though.
Yes.
That we don't dislike you for that. No. I mean, you know, I it's interesting. I always have got one eye on how's this going to come across to the listenership.
Yes.
And I kind of keen to point out, you know, he's not just a dick.
Yeah. I mean, not an arsehole. Yeah.
But you do seem to have, like, that, as well as that forceful personality, you have that kind of independence of... In the whole way you're describing the process of sort of saying you've got to go in the opposite direction, you've got no respect for authority, you've got to do your own sort of thing. And I think, like, we as an audience let you do that. Do we let you do anything, or do you let us do stuff? Because you are super high status.
I let the audience think that it's their idea. But
Well,
I remember thinking this years ago when I did stand-up, and I do think that I think most comedians unlock this thought. When you walk on stage, the trick to the performance of stand-up, in my view, is you are letting the audience believe that they've found you funny by themselves.
Let's go through that again. Okay,
it's a weird sentence. It's like I'm saying, like, when a stand-up is really good, the audience believes that they just found you funny, like it was their idea that they found you funny.
Okay.
You don't go on stage and say, you're going to find me funny.
Sure.
You go out and you talk about things and the audience laughs and you look at the audience as if to say, I don't know why that was funny.
Yes, okay.
A little bit. Okay. It's a conceit.
Yes.
You know? So you got to let the audience believe it's their own idea. Like the audience that, you know, audiences that are seeing me in New Zealand, this is my first time at the New Zealand Comedy Festival, which is an interesting contrast for me because I'm quite battle weary of festivals in Australia, but these are people who have never seen me live before, and there's a thrill of discovery in that audience. They feel like they've found a winner.
Yeah,
I knew I was a winner all along.
Yeah, okay.
But I let them think that they've found that.
So let's look at that in the context of Do you think you're revealing anything on stage? Because it seems like you that could be interpreted as you are showing us what you want to show us. You're almost like a magician. We are witnessing the effect.
Yes.
And we're thinking that we see the truth, but actually we're seeing what you're portraying.
Absolutely.
Is there an extent to which you are actually revealing something honest as well?
Yeah, I reckon I do, but in so much as like a film can reveal something honest, like a film can reveal an honest, you know, an honest opinion of an artist, but at the end of the day, there were 30 people on set with lighting and whatever, like a lot of effort went into doing that thing.
Okay.
I reveal a certain honesty when I'm sort of flailing about screaming and carrying on because my daughter got a needle.
Sure.
You know, that is an honesty. And I've heard, like, you know, people who are parents, you know, it actually makes them a bit teary when they say that.
Yes, because they've been through that experience.
Yeah, because it's true. But it's an honesty I've chosen to reveal.
Sure.
So I am definitely revealing, but it's only because I chose that I wanted. It's only because I wanted to be at that point, you know.
Was there a point where you didn't feel in control? Where you?
Yes, absolutely. When I started, my first 12 months, I used to play a character. Okay. And the character was a nervous type person, and I did that for practical reasons, because when you're nervous, if a lot of new open micers do that, have a nervous persona.
Yeah.
Because you can hide your nerves within the nerves.
Sure.
And so there was that. And then I did that for 12 months, and then I stopped doing a character because it just felt embarrassing carrying a costume around to gigs. And you know, in backwater pubs.
Sure.
So from a practical point of view, I just started performing as myself because it was easier. And but no, when I started, I was very kind of, well, I was quite young too. I was like 22 or something when I started, and I was very likable and probably not dissimilar to Seinfeld. I was just observational stuff mostly, and I was quite a clean act too. I pretty much didn't swear. And all that just slowly just, you know, deteriorated,
yeah,
you know, as I wanted to become more and more interesting.
Okay.
So looking back on it, I was competent, but I think I was quite boring.
Okay.
When I started.
Okay. I've got a couple of questions I want to answer in different directions off that. You were competent, but you were boring. And you recognised that that wasn't going to... What was the impetus to be less boring? Were you boring yourself, or were you thinking, I want to make a success of this, I need to become more interesting?
Yeah, I just thought, yeah, I think you got to stand out from the crowd, and I'd look around and I'd sort of look at people who were doing really well and think, what is it about them that makes them so good? And
sure. So something I often wonder or worry about, I sort of think I need to be true. I think I've said on the show before that all I feel you can really do is show yourself as honestly as possible, mm-hmm, and then cross your fingers and hope it's zeitgeist and it's of interest to the moment. Well, you're agreeing with that, but at the same time, it sounds like you're not as kind of constrained by that desire to honestly be yourself. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
To what extent have you kind of constructed this because you think it'll be successful?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's funny. It's a bit of both.
Mm.
Because, like, in Australia, like, you know, for the context in the UK, like, I perform to 300 people a night in festivals,
sure,
who pay money and want to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And so my impetus is to... I'm trying to perform... I'm trying to be good and interesting and entertain those people... But the other thing I'm trying to aim for is, like, these are people now who've been to my show 5, 6, 7 years in a row.
Okay.
And they've enjoyed it and they've thought it was really funny. So I'm always trying to give them something that's a bit familiar and something they've never seen before.
Yes.
Okay. I do a bit of both.
Okay.
So this year it was religion.
Sure.
So the other 2/3 of the show were probably areas or themes or subjects that they may have seen before.
Okay.
But, obviously the material's different, but maybe the attitudes and the observations or... The more the attitudes and the themes might have crossover with other shows, but then I give them a whole thing about giving religion an absolute belting that they haven't seen.
Yes.
And then they feel alive when they see that.
Okay.
So I'm definitely thinking about the show being a success, but that doesn't mean that, like, I'm just a complete populist, like, sellout. Like,
sure.
It's just like,
sure,
oh, yeah, I'm just doing these jokes because these are the kinds of jokes people like to hear. My motivation is impure and pure at the same time. I'm doing it because I want lots of people to turn up and pay and give me money. That's why I'm doing it.
Yeah, sure.
But the way that I do that is I try to make a show that's so good that people want to tell their friends about it. And my feeling is that people only talk about shows that are so good if there's an element of originality and connection in them.
Yes, okay.
So I'm aiming for those honest moments and those twists and turns and stand-up that hopefully they have feel that they've never seen before.
Sure.
Because that makes you excited and want to tell your friends about it.
Sure. So is the self-expression part of your career, your shows, is the self-expression, like you getting things off your chest and saying what's on your mind and revealing yourself to the world, is that more or less important to you than the kind of the, I don't want to say power trip, I know we were talking in those terms, but more or less important than the kind of vicarious pleasure from a career that's working and an audience that's laughing? And you know what I mean? It's like you're a success. It's a successful thing.
Yes.
And is that... What's the dynamic there between it, you're a successful thing? You're, you know what I mean? You're a successful...
I'm a very successful thing.
You're a successful man, product, brand. You know what I mean? All those sort of things. People come back to see you in their hundreds and pay year on year. In their thousands. And so is part of you thinking, when you put the show together, are you thinking... And I ask this not just specifically for you, but also for someone of your level who's turning over this kind of material every year. You're 12 hours in. I'm 3 hours in on my own sort of stuff. And I feel like I'm kind of trying to go, okay, this year, what is it that I want to say?
Yeah.
And maybe that's you're less constrained by that, thinking, okay, like you used a phrase which I found really interesting earlier on about, like, you've got to get some minutes together.
Yeah.
So, you know, are you thinking, right, this year I've had a child and I want to express the joy of having a child? Or are you thinking, I've got to get some minutes together, what is it that's going on in my life?
Yeah, I have absolute
faith. That was the longest question I think I've ever asked anyone.
I have absolute faith in my comic perspective. I've been doing it so long now that I just believe I live a comedian's life. I notice funny things when they happen and I'm good at trapping lightning in a bottle. That's what I do and I'm good at it. So I don't sweat it. I just know that things will happen to me and I know that if I think nothing's happening to me, it's just because I haven't looked at things close enough. So I don't think, oh, this is what everyone's been talking about or I've got this that I want to say. I mean, I kind of think of it more in terms of, I think about it more in what do I want to say, because I'm going to have to say it over and over again, so I've got to care about it. So I only talk about things I care about a lot, because you've got to care about it a lot. So that's usually from within, you know. So they're usually, say the rant about the iPhone 5 that was in the show this year. That's because I bored probably 10 dinner parties. Oh, what's going on with the iPhone 5? It's giving me the shits. Like it was something that obviously was getting my goat. And to some degree would make people laugh, but not necessarily that just they would agree that it was a bit of a rip-off as well. And then and I'm like, well, this is something to talk about, isn't it? So that's usually how I get at it, or, you know. So a lot of my material starts as dinner table conversation with my friends who are non-comedians.
Okay.
So they're just the things that we enjoy talking about a lot, because I think private conversations are some of the best sources, one of the best sources for material, because quite often private conversations are offhand and honest.
Sure.
So if it entertains you a lot, you know, if it's a topic that somehow people are like if you are complaining about customer service and everyone's got their customer service story that they hate and you find, gee, we've been talking about that for 90 minutes. Clearly that's something that maybe
worth talking about.
Okay.
Brilliant. I'm just going to make a little note there, 49 minutes, that I need to stop and work out what other stuff I want to ask you.
I'm really
pleased with this, mate. This is great. We talked earlier on about you, or something you said earlier about you not finding yourself funny, because you're saying things you think and you think them anyway.
Yes.
So were you funny as a kid? Were you funny amongst your group of friends?
I was privately funny and I wasn't publicly funny. So when I was, when I was in primary school, I was kind of a funny guy, but I was... I went to a school where there was nobody there. There was like 26 kids in my school, the whole school in where I grew up, in country New South Wales. So I was always the funny one in the school play, but that wasn't saying much because there weren't many people there. That was pretty much untested. And then I went to boarding school for 6 years in Sydney. So at the age of 11, I went to boarding school. All boys, 1,000 boys living in Sydney together. And within that environment, I wasn't funny at all. I was funny just with my mates.
Yeah.
but we were kind of like a nerdy little crew. We're all sort of good at maths and science and we're sort of academically good. Yeah. But my school was a rugby school. So basically, humour was outsourced to the people who were good at sport. That was the general agreement.
Okay.
You're only allowed to be funny if you're good at sport.
Yeah.
So there's a jocular sense of humour there, which I mocked to my friends.
Yes.
So I was funny in my little group, but not to the greater school. So then I went to university and I was playing in bands. So I was obviously desperate to express myself in some way. Despite myself, I used to write poetry, whatever. I was just obviously trying to do something.
Yeah.
And it became apparent to me that when I was introducing songs, I could make the crowd laugh. So eventually I went into comedy competition because I just had this feeling that I knew how to manipulate a room into making them laugh.
telling sentence.
Yeah. I felt okay with it. So there's all of that going on. And but I often describe, when you become a comedian, it's like coming out. You know, my brother's gay. When he came out, looked back through his life, realised he was gay all along.
Yeah.
When I worked out I was a comedian, I looked back through my life, I'm like, I did kind of memorise Bill Cosby records. I had a John Cleese poster instead of a band poster. I used to volunteer for the funny roles in primary school. I used to make my friends laugh, you know. So then it kind of all made sense to me. And then another little pleasure that I found, I think there's a pleasure in fun. It's sometimes when you become an entertainer, it feels weird to feel like it came out of nowhere because you sort of feel like there's a certain arrogance that you, why did you decide that you were the one that could do it? Like it's a bit. So the other thing I found solace in was my grandfather, who died a year after I was born. He was a politician and apparently an amazing public speaker.
Okay.
So knowing that just sort of feels like, oh, okay, maybe it comes from somewhere. I like that.
Sure.
And this sort of also taps into a theme of last year's show. Last year's show, I saw my mother do stand-up. She just did a gong show on a cruise I was on out of nowhere.
Not at your behest. She just did it for fun.
And she drilled it, and it was just, it blew my head off.
By drilled it, you mean she did well?
She just killed it.
I'm not familiar with that.
She killed it. So that was...
That's incredible. Was your granddad, was your politician granddad her dad?
No.
No. Oh, wow. So you've got a double legacy.
It's like, okay. It's good to feel like you come from somewhere. And, getting back to the whether I was funny when I was younger, the amusing thing is for everyone in my high school, when I popped up on TV as a comedian, it made no sense at all.
Yes.
So okay. I was at my 20-year reunion for high school last year, and all of them, I mean, they're all very excited about it, and they feel happy for me, and the school has a good spirit, so just the fact you went to the same school is a good feeling, but for a lot of them it's like, where the fuck did that come from?
Yeah, sure. I've written Lex Luthor. Yeah. I don't know why I've written that. I think I've written that because I've never heard anyone talk about the glee, the power trip. And it is a power, of course it is.
Yes, yes.
No one really talks about that. I do like to make people laugh. I do like to make people happy. But I suppose part of it is me going, I've got lots of unresolved. I didn't have a happy time at school, especially. And part of me is kind of going, see? Do you know what I mean? That's quite an interesting...
Well, the power trip part too comes from, it's fun to be in charge. And so, I've got a reputation for being good with hecklers. And essentially, the way I deal with a heckler... Well, I used to hate hecklers. I used to hate them because I thought, I've got all this prepared material and why are you ruining it? That's really annoying and you're boring everyone. I wish you wouldn't do that. But one day I worked out, which everyone has no doubt worked out, I worked out that it was a compromise to my authority on stage. They were compromising my authority, and the audience, I realised, wanted me to be back in charge. They actually want me to win. So once I realised that, I thought, well, I might as well win in 8 different ways. Yes. So when someone heckles me, usually I take what they've said, I pull it apart, I question their motivations, I question their confidence as a heckler. Have you done it before? Maybe this is your first time. I just pull it all apart in extreme detail.
Yeah.
Until eventually they, lose the will to live.
Yeah.
And, okay. And my rule is I just kind of pull it all apart and have fun with it and mock them. And I just have a very simple rule, and that is if the audience applauses, you're finished.
Yes.
Because I don't know where the clap's going to come. They'll eventually clap when you just nail it.
So you keep clap, going. So if someone heckles, you don't stop tearing into pieces until there's a round of applause. Amazing.
Then you move on. I mean, unless you feel it's just dipping away, then and you can sense that the audience is tired of it.
Sure.
But you'll always just happen upon something that will just snap and they will clap and then, you move on. Yeah. Because they want you to win.
Yes. They a heckle is an opportunity for you to get an applause break.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so you might as well chase it. Yeah. You might as well chase it down. Yeah, don't gloss over it. When someone heckles, it's like the gig has come alive. So don't.
Yeah.
You know, don't like it's like they've put the paddles on and they've given you an electric jolt and the body jumps to life and the gig's just suddenly up there. So you might as well keep it there.
Sure.
Rather than sort of push it aside and move on.
That is exactly what Lex Luthor would say.
But also adding to that, which is a bit strange, is I really enjoy corporate gigs because a lot of comedians quite famously hate corporate gigs. Mm. They're the gigs you do that pay a lot of money and often they're in conditions that are not perfect. But I enjoy them because once you see them as a power trip, they're much easier. So when you do a gig like that, you're exerting authority over the boss of the company.
Okay.
And that's a great place to be and to mock a company and to mock the whole thing. Yeah. And also, they're common jokes, and then I'm not pretending to have made up the idea, but I'll always mention very early on, don't worry, I can't get fired. You know, I've already been paid.
Yeah, okay.
So, the employee's like, oh, you can say anything.
Amazing, amazing. And have you, as a strategy, do you get paid in advance?
It's half true. Get paid half. I think there's a deposit of half that's already paid.
Okay, that's a good tactic.
It's true enough.
Yeah, it's true enough, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
It's true enough that the, you know,
that's my favourite moment I've ever had at a corporate was slamming the boss about like
corporate 101, but it's important.
Yeah,
it's actually really important.
And you're told not to. You've got to ignore all the instructions.
So you've got to do it
because you're never going to get booked again.
Yeah,
you know they never rebook. Or you know, once
they only ever do each one once. Absolutely. Yeah. So you might as well go in and rip them to shreds because it's kind of what they want. Like it's and also. A corporate gig is difficult, so you've got to bring in the big guns to try to get everything on side. So you've got to pull all those tricks and pull those moves.
Mm.
Otherwise, they're not going to listen to the other things that you've got to say.
Sure.
So you've got to use that to get them in. That's the way I see it.
Okay. So there was something I made an observation about a review of yours. I was looking at a positive review of yours recently online. And realising that by doing that, I tricked myself back into engaging with reviews, which is like a personal quest that I'm on at the moment, is to not engage with any of it.
That's funny, because I'm the opposite. I just read all the reviews and go, oh, fuck it. What would they know anyway?
Well, this is almost exactly what I'm getting at, which is that you seem to have... So where does this come from, this unshakable confidence?
It's a trick.
Is it a trick you've learned? Have you... Like, I wouldn't be surprised now if you told me that you'd gone away and done a month doing an LP training or something like that.
No, well, it came from... It became my thing. It became my... That's my trick, is to be confident. But it's still an illusion. It's a... Yeah, it's a poker game. This whole thing is a big poker game, and you've got to have a good poker face. You've got to have a good poker face for audience, for press, for reviews, for everything. And you've got to, you know, you've got to have a certain amount of front. And, you know, I still have my insecurities, like everyone else does, but I just don't see them as being anything entertaining to talk about.
Okay.
So I hold them in a little bit. You know, my wife could probably reveal that I'm just like every other comedian.
Sure.
But I just don't walk around town with my heart on my sleeve so that's, I can shit on it.
I feel like I'm supposed to as a comedian. I'm supposed to be honest and open and candid about all my feelings.
Well, maybe
I don't know why I feel like that.
No, I think there is a certain... There's an aspect of that, but also comes from when you do it long enough, it just gets tired. You know, I've heard people... be self-deprecating in 20 different ways, and so it's just old news to me. Yes. I'm like, yeah, I know, we all feel like that, but whatever. It's like just saying it's a sunny day.
Yeah.
But where it came from for me a little bit too was I had to do this TV spot in Australia. It was 1999, I think. It was a while ago. And it was a big break for me. There's a TV show called Good News Week that used to exist. It's like Have I Got News For You? It's a panel show, but it had variety elements too, so often I'd get people on to do a song. So the producer really liked me and she wanted to get me in the show. She was just trying to work out a way of getting me in. And it was Science Week. So she's like, in a desperate bid to just get me in the show, she said, I know that you play music, so if you could write a song about science for Science Week, I'll be able to get you on. Now, looking back on it, that's madness to just perform a song on national TV that you've
with
never
no
done.
No musical background.
I have played music.
Sure.
So I thought, all right. So I just wrote a funny song about science. And the song was basically saying, without science, this song wouldn't exist. Mm-hmm. So it pointed out the scientific elements of the song, you know, that the strings were standing waves and you're not watching me strumming with my plectrum, you're just watching a partial reflection of the white light spectrum, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Right, okay, yeah.
And before I went on, there was this huge crowd. It was like 1,000 people or something. It was one of their big outside, they'd gone out to a theatre and doing this show, and the roar of the crowd was so loud, I remember feeling my heart thumping in my chest, and it was just belting away, and I just felt, and I, my mouth was going dry, and I felt like a real strong sense of anxiety. And I was just on the brink of starting to think, what am I doing? I don't even know if this song's funny or not. I haven't even tested it to a crowd. This is crazy. And then I thought, and it's like my, I was like, it was like I was looking after myself. I thought, how much better would this be if I was relaxed? It would be so much better. And I pictured myself being in the green room, and I thought, I will be so much happier after this if I just glide on through it. And I thought, and my heart started to slow down, and I thought, yeah, I don't give a fuck about this. Who cares? It's just TV. It's a one-off. No one will remember it anyway. What would these people know? I'll do another spot some other day. I'm just going to go out there and not care. And I tricked myself. I was able to get my heart slowed down and, you know, sort of, and I to a more of a resting state. And I just walked out and I ad-libbed something at the beginning, just a little thing, but just enough to remind myself that it didn't matter. I just, something about the mic stand I didn't like or something. I don't know, it was probably only mildly funny, but it was just to remind me that I'm just going to play a song. And then I played it, got a really big round of applause. It was just crazy. They just loved it. And then afterwards I thought that's kind of the way to do it. So I just realised how much better things will go if I'm relaxed.
Mm.
So then that just became a trick I played on myself, and then eventually it just became true. You believe it for long enough, it becomes a fact.
Are there any negative consequences ever of that amount of confidence, self-belief, being the alpha male in the room? Do you think you sacrifice vulnerability or... like any aspect of your relationship with the audience? Do you think I'm not suggesting there are. I'm just it's really refreshing to hear this amount of sort of positivity about that.
Yeah. No, it works pretty well. I think that, I don't know if you're going to look for something. I reckon, you know, it's a bit of a hedging of your bets. Like, it does make me an acquired taste to some degree, because I'm kind of, I'm not quite comfortable saying that I'm a comedian's comedian, but there's an element of pleasure in it if you've seen a bit of comedy, because it's almost like I'm making fun of comedy while doing it. Yeah. Without being unbelievably postmodern and see what I did there, and, you know, without completely pulling it apart, my stand-up act kind of mocks stand-up at the same time, kind of.
Yes.
It's kind of in there, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But it's subtle though. Like, it's, there are people who would just take it on face value and not notice.
Yes, okay.
I almost feel that I get from the, this is not really addressing what you're saying, but I almost get reviewed two ways. It's like some people cop the whole thing.
Yeah.
They enjoy the show and the subtext and they get the whole thing and they love it. And then there are other people who just see the show on face value and don't really get it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, saying the reviews for this show that you've just seen.
Yeah.
They've been outrageously positive. I did read one negative review, and to be fair, it wasn't overly negative, but it did say in passing that there were only 3 decent belly laughs in the hour.
Yeah, well, that's just wrong, isn't it?
that is completely false.
Yes, sure.
But clearly she didn't get it.
Yeah.
She just didn't really get it. She probably thought I was an obnoxious Australian, which I kind of am.
Yes.
But she didn't understand the conceit of it, I reckon.
Yes.
Like, I'm being ironic. Like, when I, you know, like, remember I said, I don't really do it, but I was trying to do that joke of, because I'm in New Zealand, and I'm saying, you all say that Australians are cocky. Yeah, that's because we're really good at it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's a funny joke, but like, there are people who would be like, no, you're not.
Yeah, totally, they totally, just absolutely. Miss the subtext, yeah.
So so the blind confidence that I perform with is its own form of, like, humour.
Yes.
But it can get lost on people.
Yes.
They can just think that you're obnoxious, and they just miss that element.
The review that I saw, one of the reviews I saw, and I can't remember which publication it was in, but it fits nicely for me into this kind of image I'm forming of whether you've done it or not, this neuro-linguistic programming or whatever it is, this secret Scientology background. Which I should just say for the benefit of the listener, I've just made up and introduced.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you can't sign up.
Yeah.
It's not that there's another chat we had that I've edited.
It's not this podcast that's been sponsored by some company.
Yeah. But the review, and maybe it was just a poorly written review, but it was positive. And it really just kind of parroted back some of the things that you impressed upon us in the show.
Yes, like
you'd go into a bit by saying, "Thing about me is I don't respect authority." You'd go into a bit about that,
yes.
And then at the end you'd go, "That's because I've got no respect for authority."
Yeah,
and it would be nothing more than a little segue.
Yeah, it's just kind of trying to frame up some stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yet this review goes, "Well, the thing about Tom Gleason is he just doesn't respect authority."
And it's like, yeah, I know, I told you that.
Yeah, I read through it and I was like, "Is this how this is working? Have you put the fluence on us?" And you're going, "I'm funny, I'm brilliant, I don't respect authority," and people are coming out going, "Mike, he's funny and brilliant, doesn't respect it."
I do hypnotise an audience a bit. Yes,
I think that's what I'm getting at. That amount of confidence, it's almost, and there's, you know, I'm not talking at all about the comedy content of the show here, which is excellent.
Yeah, it's just
but it's almost like you're doing a motivational speech, or something like those techniques.
Is what I talked about before with the feedback thing. It's like when I say, "Is there any feedback?" I'm pointing out to the audience that no, because you loved it.
Yeah.
That's an element of that's almost a sales pitch.
And is that something that you've done naturally and look back at now and go, "Oh, that's what I do," or is it something that you went in there going, "I'm gonna take these people apart and I'm gonna tell them, I'm gonna program them"?
I don't know. They're just ideas that I have, and like I said, I retrofit the purpose.
Sure.
It's like afterwards, I receive the benefits from that thought, but I don't. It doesn't come the other way around. I don't think I really have to prove to these people that I'm good.
Sure.
It's just that it comes out in what I'm saying, because I chose to talk about that thing. Yeah, I'm not that calculated.
No, sure. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it's...
Note to self, Tom would never admit if he was that calculated.
No, I mean, I still kind of... I put it together and it all comes... It's like putting together a jigsaw, and sometimes these things, they just sort of pop out and emerge. But I also just, you know, sometimes these things are like... I focus on things that make my friends laugh, like really early hints at this style that I have dates back years and years and years. Like, I had a friend, a Sydney comedian called Mick Meredith, and I perform with him regularly. He's a very funny guy. And he said to me, he goes, "I remember when I first liked you, it was like the Comedy Store in 98, it was like a long time ago," and he said, and I didn't really remember this until he told me, he said, "You said a joke and then it got a laugh, and then you said to the audience, 'You are the thickest audience I've ever performed to in my life. I've done that joke 100 times and that is the longest I've had to wait between punchline and laughter.'"
Amazing.
And he said, "And the thing that really amused me was, and they laughed and agreed with you that they were thick."
Yeah. Okay.
And so my friends would pick up on those little things, and I'm like, "Yeah, you're right." So you just keep pushing that. So now, like, one of my favorite parts of the show at the that I really enjoy performing is, it's basically a rant against customer service, but the rant has no point to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just talking about being a bad person, and I'm being awful to a person who doesn't deserve it.
Yeah.
And I even admit at the end that I was lying.
Yes, yes.
It breaks all the rules. It shouldn't exist, because I'm just saying, this is a story about me being an arsehole to someone who doesn't deserve it, and I'm lying, and I don't admit that I'm lying.
Yes.
That's not traditional comedy fodder.
No, sure, sure.
Usually you're saying something that puts you in a good light, or that maybe, you know... I don't know, but it's just...
Hello, bitches isn't an ironic twist on your warm personality at all. It's the poster that you see if you're wearing the special glasses that reveal the truth, as you're grinning.
That's true. I mean, that's true to some degree, yeah.
I've got one last area that I'd like to just explore a little bit. Which I think it's not something I often talk about with comics, but I think you'd be a good person to shed some light on it. I noticed on your, I had a little look at your Wikipedia page, having looked at some of your TV credits. Yes. It said you were briefly a panellist on Big Brother's Big Mouth.
Yes.
Right? Now, that to me doesn't necessarily sit with the Tom Gleason, the comedian that I know, because I don't have a lot of respect for those sort of shows.
Yeah,
I don't watch them myself
either,
or the rest of it. So I wanted to talk to you about the decision to go on and do some I assumed that you probably didn't respect it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the decision to do TV for stuff that you don't believe in. How do you place yourself within that?
Well, that was actually a big turning point for me.
Okay.
Because what happened, a quick version of my TV career in Australia was I came to prominence via a sketch show, and in it I did a continuing character called the Australian Fast Bowler, who was essentially a superhero who would solve problems by bowling really fast. And it was great. It was a good dress up. I looked like Dennis Lilly. I had a moustache. It was sort of 70s inspired, back before that had been given a thrashing, you know, in the comedy world. And I did various sketches on that, and I was quite a prominent face in that show. The Australian Fast Bowler was used for a lot of the promo. I was like a pin-up in the TV guide and stuff like that. So, but I was the guy who did that thing. So my stand-up was not as well known, even though I was doing that the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was I got a lot of offers after that to do different things, pitches and whatever. But then the offers just started to dry up because I believed that I was a TV star.
Yes, of course.
I believed it
because
everyone told me I was. So I didn't disagree with them. But then eventually the offers started to dry up, and I was boasting one day to my mother. I said that Dancing with the Stars asked me to go on there, and I thought, you know, they can go fuck themselves. And Mum said to me, but that sounds like it'd be a lot of fun. Maybe you should say yes to some things. And I was like, yeah, you're kind of right. Because I just started to say no to everything, and eventually the phone stopped ringing.
Sure.
So I
was, why were you saying no to everything?
Because I thought they weren't good. I thought that's not good. I'll only do things that are good. I'm going to be quite particular. I'm only going to be on TV if it's something decent.
Sure.
So it all started to dry up, and then people started having good fortune from being on shit shows. You know, this is, you know, like say, like a good example is Joan Rivers winning a Celebrity Apprentice, and somehow she's doing Full Houses again. It's weird.
Sure,
there's that element. But anyway, it got to a point where I thought, I kind of just have to get back on TV. I'm being a bit too precious. I think I just have to start saying yes to things. So I got asked to go on the Big Brother panel show. And I thought, oh, that's terrible. But I got convinced because the producer of that show really liked me.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted me to do it as a personal favour to him.
Mm-hmm.
Because the show was not doing well. And he's like, please come in. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to. So I thought, instead of thinking in this sort of pure comedy way, I started thinking like normal people think about work. You have to have good work relations.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, oh, well, I'll do him a favour and maybe this won't be the winner, but it'll get me to do something else later that I do want to do. So you got to say yes, and sometimes you got to please them. It's not all about you.
Yeah.
And he said, you can go on there and say whatever you want. Now, I had gotten back from the Middle East where I was entertaining the troops, and I'd just enjoyed a thorough lesson in saying whatever you want.
Yeah.
Because there, like I remember one of the guys from at one of the camps, the commander said, you can say whatever you want, just don't say cunt. And so I went on stage in front of the troops and said, the commander over there said I can say whatever I want as long as I don't say the word cunt. And they thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
And even he laughed. And I'm like, what are you going to do? Send me back to Australia? I don't get to hang out in this shit? Oh, yeah. What a shame. So it's on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I realised that tour, I could only be as funny as I was going to could be if I accepted the fact that I could get booted off. That's how you got to perform. So when I went on this show, I thought, I'm going to say all the things that I've hated about Big Brother. And if I get fired, I won't have any regrets. So I went on this panel show, and Tony, the host, just straight away said to me, so Tom, have you got any thoughts about the current season? Just wide open, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, yeah, to be honest, I don't really like it. I don't like it at all. Because you know what? The people in the house have become too aware of their fame. They're walking around talking about their following, what they're going to do afterwards, what we should do. This is what we should do. We should tell them that Big Brother's been cancelled.
Yeah.
That all the cameras are turned off.
Yeah.
That we're not even filming them anymore. But due to the gaming regulations, they have to stay in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to stay in there with nobody watching. And we'll find out who they really are.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I did another riff on saying that they should move the walls in by an inch each night till eventually they're, you know, and this whole thing. And it was all very funny, but it was a little bit edgy because I was basically saying on a show about Big Brother, and also the ratings were ordinary.
Yeah.
It was going down the gurgler.
Yeah.
So I kind of was making fun of the sinking ship, basically. And afterwards, the producer just had a big grin on his face and he said, thank you so much.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we needed. I wanted you to throw some hand grenades and fuck you through some.
Yeah, great.
So I got invited back the next week and I was the... So then I would just always rip the piss out of all the other panellists because often the other panellists were housemates.
Yes, okay.
So they'd be reminiscing and they'd be talking about their time in the house and this and in the house and then I did this in the house and then I'd be like, yeah, that's right. I remember back when I was in the house and oh, no, sorry, I wasn't in the house because I had a fucking job.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just... And when the panellists would come out, I think... I said, you know, I'd just be really bluntly honest. Oh, you probably think you're going to be a big star, but you probably... No one's going to remember who you are in a month, mate. How do you feel about that? So I was pretty cutting. And then... So that show existed. And then out of nowhere, Good News Week came back on air, this panel show that I was mentioned before. That's like, have I got news for you? Mm-hmm. And I was in the box seat because I'd been funny on a panel.
Yeah.
So I'm in straight away episode two. And that season ran out and I was probably appeared more on the... I did appear on that show more than any other guest.
Sure.
And that basically pushed me straight back into the spotlight again.
So the lesson here is accept everything, but be prepared to be fired from everything.
Yes. And also sometimes... You might do a shit little thing, but of course it can lead to another thing. And this idea that your career gets make or break by one appearance is absolute bullshit.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, like people love that. People used to tell me that they hated Big Brother but liked watching me.
Mm.
So you can carve out your own little corner there, you know, in mainstream media.
Mm.
But yeah, that comes from having a strong comic voice probably as well. You know, if you got to know exactly why you're there and what you're doing.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure. We've sort of got to end there. But the last little thing I realised during this interview that I had seen you in Queensland at Sit Down Comedy.
Yes.
When Lindsay and Will were doing their kind of late night thing, you were sat at the back wearing a cap. I'd just closed the show beforehand.
That's right. Yeah.
And I just wanted to share this. There was a lovely moment where they were very funny.
Yeah.
And one of my favourite things in it was because Will kept spilling his numerous drinks.
Yeah.
And Lindsay
let very late night loose show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, an improvised kind of knockabout thing. And one of my favourite lines in it was when Lindsay went, "You really don't like that top bit, do you?" Because he kept spilling it, killed me. But there was, you know, as well as the highs, there were, by the nature of the thing, there were some lows as well, some quiet bits. And there was just a lovely moment. I've only just, having been in a bus with you for a week on tour, I'd completely forgotten about this, but it was really nice and I think typical of your standing that someone, another comic who I didn't know, stood next to you during a low. He just looked up at me and he went, "Save us, Tom." And what I love was you didn't.
That's right.
You didn't. You didn't go on and you could have got on and picked up on the balls.
No, they're fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Let them play. I couldn't run into there. I was sober at the time too and it wouldn't have fit.
It would have been quite weird, wouldn't it, I suppose?
Yeah. Because at the time I wasn't drinking. I'd had I did the whole Adelaide Fringe sober. So I just, by the time I got to Brisbane, they're both drunk and I'm sober. It just would not work.
Sure. Oh, you did Adelaide sober. That makes sense. That enables me to make more sense of your prodigious drinking on this festival.
Yeah, no, well, I'm drinking a lot now because my family's away. Like, I'm here on my own, so I'm taking advantage.
Yeah, mate. Yeah. Thank you very much. That's brilliant. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
Nice one. Oh, I miss him already. Thanks to Tom, thanks to everyone at the New Zealand International Comedy Festival for a genuinely amazing month. I had so much fun. Back next week with the only other podcast I recorded there. I was generally too busy swimming in the sea or climbing volcanoes and so on. We have an interview coming up with a performer of the characters Ivan Brackenbury and Ian D. Montford. That's Mr. Tom Binns. I'll speak to you then.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.